The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Culture Map presents What's Eric Eating? From the Gal Media Studios in Houston, Texas, here's Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler. I have John Holler from Holler Brewing Company coming up in a little bit. But first, I'm joined by my co-host this week. She is the blogger behind SwankyMaven.com, Felice Sloan. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hey. I'm doing good. How are you doing, E?
I'm good. I'm glad you're here. We have much to discuss, but before we get started, I did want to tell you that I did have one listener come to me and say, you are his favorite co-host. And if that's it were up so to weird. Him... If it were up to him, it would just be Eric and Felice every week.
Well, you know what? I hope Linda doesn't listen to this episode because she is going to talk crap the next time she comes in. But I appreciate that. I wish it were more of Felice and Eric, but, you know, we have to be fair. So thanks for that.
I will pass that along. All right. Let us dive right into the news of the week. Topic number one. Big news out of New Orleans. Acme Oyster House has claimed the former El Real space for its Houston location. It could open as soon as this fall. Felice, I know you go to New Orleans on a pretty regular basis. Have you been to Acme Oyster House? And if so, what do you think of it?
Yes. Good news. More seafood, more oysters for us. I have visited Acme. It is not necessarily my favorite just because I have other favorites when I go. However, if they're coming to Houston, I'm super excited because it gives us, more char grilled oysters and again, more seafood options. So I'm pretty excited.
Yeah. So, we can be a little bit honest here, right? It's in the French Quarter. It's been around for about 100 years. So it has the reputation as being kind of a tourist trap.
Right, yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that it won't do well here, because I think anything that has that kind of New Orleans cachet, people are really excited about. But just for funsies, play a little compare and contrast with me. How is Acme different from Neo's, which is the other New Orleans-based kind of oystery seafood restaurant that opened here about a year and a half ago?
It's just a different, to me, it's a completely different vibe. Because again, as you said, you have that whole French Quarters element of Acme. So it's just real touristy, right? But if you're in the French Quarters, you want char grilled oysters, for me, I would go there. Neo's has bigger flavors. They're more consistent. So it's just a whole different vibe. Completely different vibe. What are your thoughts?
Well, I haven't been to Acme, so I'm a little bit reluctant. I am intrigued in the sense that they are known for their Wall of Fame, which you can get on by eating 15 dozen oysters. And I don't know that I necessarily could eat 15 dozen oysters, but I am down to try.
I think I will be down to try it. I've never even had the desire to do it, right? Let's just like You know, there's some challenges that I'm like, I'm cool doing. I don't know if I would even want to do that, because at the point where I get halfway through, I'm like, I don't want oysters for a while. And that's something that, you know, I love oysters. So I don't know if I'm really ready for the challenge. But the day you decide to do it, I definitely want to be on hand to get footage so we can kind of talk crap about it.
Well, the other thing is, I don't know how much that costs, right? Because it's 180 oysters. So even at $2 a throw, that's right. A lot of oysters.
That's a lot of money
is what it really is. It's like, you know, it's a pretty fancy dinner.
It is.
But there's something just, you know, Rob Walsh did it when he was working on the book, Sex, Death, and Oysters. And so I just feel sort of compelled. Like I want to try it.
You feel like it's a bucket list item at this point for you.
A little bit, yeah. I'm not usually down with these like big eating challenges, but I think I might make an exception for
active. Yeah, I think you should definitely go for it. You know, we may try to get you a sponsor or something to offset the cost. You know, I think it sounds good.
That's right. We may need Culture Map. I may need to bump the expense report for that month.
Right.
All right. Let us move on to topic number two, which I've described as a wave of closings sort of that have happened and that are coming.
Yeah, it's we're into that. We kind of talked about it, right? We're starting to see that wave happen, and it's sad, but you know, it was bound to happen.
Right. So no bigger news, weirdly, than that the Starbucks at the corner of West Gray and Shepherd that was made famous by Lewis Black and his The End of the Universe rant closed. That is to say, the one on the south side.
Right.
Starbucks on the north side with the drive through is still very much open.
Right. Please don't get it confused. And
right. And I was explaining this to someone who doesn't live in Houston that this had been a pretty popular story. And they're like, well, I mean, a Starbucks closing? I mean, the restaurant industry is in like this huge crisis and restaurants are closing all over the country and you're writing about a Starbucks. And it's like, well, yes, but it's a very famous Starbucks.
Right. You're like, you had to give them context around it. They probably were still like, okay, whatever. And you, to add that the other one is literally across the street. Like,
right. It's less funny if you haven't seen the Lewis Black bit. And of course, if you have, then you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So it's like, okay, got it.
All right. Topic number two, part B. More important in the closing hierarchy, Dolce Vita, Marco Weil's casual pizzeria Italian restaurant, is going to wrap things up at the end of the month. This is not unexpected. Weil's had put the building on Westheimer for sale about a year ago, so we kind of knew this was a matter of time.
But we even discussed it on one of the episodes about this. We talked about it. So we knew this was coming sooner than later.
Well, it turned out to be later than sooner because it's been almost a year. But this is a pretty significant restaurant. I mean, in a lot of ways, it sort of introduced Neapolitan-style pizza to Houston. It had that really great menu of like pastas, small plates, and all the Italian wine list. You know, if DeMarco kind of set a certain standard for fine dining, you know, Dolce Vita kind of paved the way for a lot of more casual restaurants. I mean, I'm not going to say that like there's no Cultivare without Dolce Vita before it, but it certainly sort of proved that there was a market for an affordable, independent, creative restaurant. And, you know, it's not a place that I've been to very much in the last, say, 2-3 years, but it certainly had its place, and it's a restaurant that I respected quite a bit.
Yeah, I think I mentioned before, I feel bad for the people that love it and live over there, but I'm not necessarily going to miss it. I never went over there. It's been years. So this one, I don't feel a certain way. You know, I don't.
Right. Well, obviously, you know, people who want that Neapolitan style pizza, you know, Pizarro's is not very far away.
Right.
People who want pasta in small plates, I would recommend Weights and Measures. Or maybe you go a little farther down Westheimer to Giacomo's, but you have options. This is not...
Exactly. It's not going to leave a big hole in the market there.
Right. And of course, Marco Wiles owns DeMarco, which is fine dining, but also Vinoteca Pascal, which is right down the street from Dolce Vita, is pretty casual and will scratch some of the same itches. So you're not bereft. All right. Closing number three, the West Side location of Ragin' Cajun, that is to say the one at Westheimer and Gessner, is closing after 20 years. You know, again, like over the years, I have developed other places that I go for kind of Cajun-style food, but I'm reasonably sure that it was either Ragin' Cajun or Papado was like the first place I ever had crawfish.
Yeah. You know?
And so it's been, you know, it's been such a pioneer. And of course, it was a staple in that neighborhood. You know, it was open for 20 years. So I just felt like it was worth acknowledging. I don't know. What is your sort of Ragin' Cajun relationship?
You know, if there's a Ragin' Cajun that I go to, I always pass that one up because it's always empty. I'm actually shocked that they're just now closing, like, just to be honest with you, because it really is more of a neighborhood spot at this point. I like going to the Ragin' Cajun. There's one in Sugar Land, or the one on Richmond, the original, which I think are the one in Richmond still going to be open. So I like going there just because it's a good scene. It's a good feel. I like the energy of it if I go to Ragin' Cajun. But
right.
Yeah, as far as the neighborhood, I think that because there's more offerings in that neighborhood now, and so you see a shift. So this one doesn't come as a shock to me, because literally it's right there next to the El Tiempo, which is always busy. They're never, it's just never busy.
Right. And obviously, if you're in that part of West Houston and you want crawfish, you have a million options in Chinatown. Matt Harris, who's on the show on a pretty regular basis, introduced me to Genevieve's, which is on Westheimer, just mm-hmm. outside the Beltway. They are known for having exceptionally large crawfish. So you got options. All right. Closing number four, the original Dak and Bop in the Museum District. The Korean Fried Chicken restaurant is going to close on Memorial Day. They, of course, have a second location that they opened last year. It's not in the Heights. It's really Lazy Brook Timber Grove, but on 18th Street. So again, if you live in the Museum District, losing Dak and Bop and you know, they make really great fried chicken, and I always appreciated their cocktails, their Japanese whiskey selection, all of that. But, you know, this is going to sting a little bit. But you still have the other location to go to.
Now, you know what? I agree with you. And one thing I was thinking about, and you may know the answer to this, with them closing that location and it being a different concept, are they going to modify the second location to kind of take some of the best dishes off of that menu and combine it so they can service everybody?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked. So I talked to the owner, Jason Cho, and he said they're going to run what he calls the OG menu to have, you know, the four or five most popular dishes from the original Dak and Bop will be on the menu at the new Dak and Bop.
Well, so see, there you go. So the biggest loss is for the people in the Museum District, right? Because that helps them. And I like the second location better anyway.
It is a more comfortable setup. It's got more parking. It's a bigger menu. Yes, there are things about the second Dak and Bop. It's a bigger, better, badder Dak and Bop for sure.
Yeah.
And then finally, This is just coming out this week, is that the original Treebeards in Market Square will not be renewing its lease on that location. They are moving on. Of course, there are four other Treebeards locations downtown. All of those will remain open. And they are working on opening a new location on I-10 just east of Bunker Hill. And I was trading emails with one of their owners today who told me that they have recruited Matt Marcus of the Eatsy Boys to do their bar menu, and Linda Salinas, who is a regular force of nature on this podcast, she's doing the cocktails for them. So
yeah, I just read that. I was pretty excited about that. It kind of takes the sting away for me, even though there are three additional locations downtown, which I never went to, always went to the Market Street location. But the new location, I've been excited about it. And when I found out Matt and Linda are involved, it's exciting. I'm like, okay, what are they cooking up? So it kind of takes that sting away for me.
Yeah, no, I was a summer intern at Shell Oil in the mid 90s. So my first Treebeard experience was actually underground at the 1100 Smith Street location.
Okay.
Yeah, in the tunnel. So I don't feel quite the same, but the old Culture Map office used to be in the north part of downtown. So Market Square was our Treebeards, and I sort of recognized that it's a historic block. I mean, it's right next to Warren's Inn, the sort of legendary Houston dive bar. There's still a lot of Treebeards, and my excitement about this new Memorial location, which will be the first Treebeards to serve dinner, and that they're bringing in these kind of young guns to freshen things up a little bit. I just, you know, that's all to the good as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. And then topic number three, there's been some changes at Weights and Measures. There are new owners, Gene Frazier and Catherine McNeil. They bought out the founders and the former partners, including John Deal, the owner of El Patio, Ian Rosenberg, who still owns Mongoose versus Cobra and 13 Celsius, Mike Sammons, who was one of the founders of 13 Celsius and now owns How to Survive on Land and Sea, and Chef Richard Kaplan, who retired. Mm. And so Richard is retired. So now Fernando Rios, who was his second in command, I don't know if he was the executive chef or the chef de cuisine, you know, those chef titles, they get a little fuzzy sometimes.
Right.
But Fernando has been number two, Richard's number two for a long time. He is now in charge of the kitchen. And Angela Moore, who had been at the Pass and Provisions for a long time, she is now the general manager. I mean, you and I both have a certain affection for Weights and Measures. I guess just like kind of where does it sort of rank for you? I mean, like what do you think of that place?
So if I have friends in town, you know, it's one of those places, definitely if I have friends in town, that's a spot that I would like to take them to, right? Because it kind of represents Houston in a way, far as brunching. I would definitely take them there for that. One of the things that I always laugh when I talk to people are like, oh, Weights, if you're not a Weights and Measures person, you still know about it and you feel a certain way. They're like the little engine that could. They're always reinventing themselves to stay relevant. And I think it's cool. I think that's one of the cool things I think about what they started out as, which was super exciting, and they're always evolving. So I'm excited for them, excited for the future. And I'm glad they're not going away and they're surviving through this whole thing, you know, and that the carrot pizza is still going to be on the menu.
No, the carrot pizza is not going anywhere.
that they're smart enough. It's still going to be on the menu. So yeah, I'm happy. I'm happy for us as diners and people have an appreciation for it.
You know, there would be rioting if they tried to take that. There would be protests. You know, I talked to Chef Fernando and Angela, and I was so, you know, what's the big difference between, you know, the old owners and the new owners? And basically they just said, you know, the new owners, you know, they trust us. They've put us in charge. They want us to be successful. They put a little bit of money into the place, right? They built out a bigger private dining room. They took some space from the kind of the bar lounge. They upgraded some of the stuff behind the scenes in the kitchen. And now they're going to be open for breakfast 6 days a week. So they're closed on Mondays, but they're doing breakfast during the week, Tuesday through Friday. Of course, as you said, it's a very popular brunch destination. And it just feels like it's like kind of a little more focused. You know, they cut the prices on the wine list so that it's kind of picking up the slack from when Ibiza closed. You know, like if it can kind of be that casual neighborhood hang for breakfast and lunch, and maybe slightly more elevated at dinner with a great affordable wine list. You know, that, I mean, it's a restaurant that I really enjoy. It's a date night spot for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like maybe sometimes a first date, sometimes a second or a third, but like it's pretty inevitable that if I'm, you know, somewhat serious about someone, that eventually we will go to Weights and Measures, just because I think it's got such a great vibe.
Yeah. You know? So see, you just said something. It wouldn't be a first date spot, because it would be if they make it, kind of, if they make it, then you're taking them there. You don't want to take them there on your first date and you're like, wah, wah, then, you know, it's your spot. No, Eric, you're doing it all wrong.
The nice thing about taking someone there on a first date is I know they'll make me look good.
Oh, okay. Right? That's good. That's a good way to think about it. Okay.
They'll be happy to see me. The food will be really tasty. You know, we'll have a bottle of wine. Like, I just, you know, it's not going to cost me an arm and a leg. You know, I value all of those aspects in a first date restaurant.
Got it. Okay. Got it.
All right. long story longer, as we've been talking here for a minute, I do think that you know, these changes are positive, and I am excited about them. And so, we'll see what Fernando and Angela do with the place, but I think it's poised for success.
I do too. I think, and if someone hasn't visited there in a while, it gives you a reason to go, you know, to go check out what they have going on now. So I'm excited to get back. I haven't been there for breakfast in a long time, so that they're, you know, expanding those days, I can give them a breakfast shout out again.
Well, right. They tried breakfast in the very beginning when it first opened, and they gave up on it after less than 6 months.
Right.
And so this is one of those things where they've brought it back and they're committed to it. And there's just not that many places for a sit down breakfast during the week, especially in Midtown. I mean, really, their only competition is Harry's. And so, you know, if they build it around their pastries and some of the greatest hits from the brunch menu, like the avocado toast, you know, you just have to kind of stick to it. But breakfast is kind of an interesting meal for a restaurant, because once you get in someone's rotation, you know, they might come to you 2, 3, 4 times a week.
I agree. And to that point, I think we need way more breakfast spots in Houston, but that's a whole nother, that's another conversation for another day. So there you go.
Yes. All right, Felice, that does it for the news of the week. We'll be right back with our restaurants of the week. Stick around.
You're listening to What's Eric Eating?
So, Felice, for our restaurants of the week, I want to talk to you about some of the places where you have been ordering to go. Have you dined at a restaurant yet since they reopened? Have you ventured out?
I've ventured out, but I haven't dined. I ventured out. The one spot that I would have dined that I went to was Corkscrew. Right, because, you know, they have that. I went to Corkscrew. They have the whole outdoors area. But it was so many people, and they were social distancing. I was just like, you know what? I'm good. I can just take this to go. So I have not. I've gone in to get it, and my intentions were to do it. And then if I see people or more people than I'm comfortable with, then I just get it wrapped up. But I have ventured out, and I went. Where did I go? I just went somewhere. I just.
Didn't you go to Roberto, Chef Roberto's new chicken restaurant?
Yes. Thank you. I'm like, I just went somewhere this weekend. Yes. Chicken House. I went out there where it's outside the Loop. It's fast casual, and it was. They're dining or takeout. So I had called it in with the intention of taking out. Then I saw Chef Roberto, and my thoughts were to dine there. But it's a little bit smaller, and I just kept it to go. But we'll talk. Can we talk about that restaurant real quick?
Yes, no, please do. I'm eager to hear about it because he opened. Ah, God, this is so bad.
Chicken Station.
That's right. The Chicken Station in East End, Second Ward, whatever that is, which is a really pretty delicious, fast casual Peruvian chicken restaurant. So I'm really curious to hear how the new place is going.
Okay. So I don't think he's even affiliated with that anymore.
Not anymore. No.
Yeah, but it was good. So this place, I think it's 10 times better just off the bat. So if you like that, you'll really enjoy this. It reminds me, it really does give me that feel of old school Latin Bites as a more casual spot. Like the big flavors, definitely. I was impressed when I went to Chicken Station when he was there, but I was more impressed when I went and checked it out. I did some chicken, a couple of the sandwiches, the sides. Yeah, so I definitely think that they're going to do well. One of the things he was saying, he was shocked to open, you know, they opened right in the middle of all this happening. And it was like they could not open or they could move forward with opening. And they moved forward and he's like, they've been busy. They've been busy, and which is very interesting because they are in the energy corridor. So they have the potential to be very dead because all those businesses are closed. But as I sat there, because it took a while because I ordered lots of stuff, and it was a steady stream of people coming and going. So I'm excited for them. I'm really excited. And this puts him in the his sister, which was part owner, the sister and the brother-in-law in Latin Bites. They were all together, puts them all back together again. And I think they're a really good team. They understand how to work together and what is needed. So I think you will be impressed when you go.
You know, this, I was just looking this up. So it looks like it's at, it's basically at Park Row and Highway 6 is what it looks like.
It literally is. Like right when you exit and you go to that light, make a left, it's literally right there. If you know where Top Golf is, it's the Top Golf. It's behind that. It's behind the Top Golf. There's a strip center, a street, right? That's Park Row. It's right there. Yeah.
All right. Well, that I can find that. No, I really liked what he did at Chicken Station. So I am. So for you to tell me it's better than Chicken Station, that has my attention.
Yeah. And so then when you go, let me know. I'll meet you there.
Yeah. So you mentioned going to Corkscrew and feeling like even though there was social distancing, there were maybe like too many people, even though everybody was following the rules, they were still far enough apart. I kind of felt that way when I went to Brasserie 19 last week.
Okay.
You know, I sat on the patio, and again, they had a lot of space between tables. They had hand sanitizer out on the table for people to use, for the staff to use. The staff were wearing masks and gloves. You know, everything was following the rules. Everybody was following the rules. And it still made me a little bit nervous to be around that many other people. So I don't quite know how we, like, mentally kind of make the leap to feel, like, more normal again. But you know, Brasserie was kind of my dip the toe in the water, see how it goes.
Yeah.
And
but, you know, what was interesting about Corkscrew, and I think because they're two different type of restaurants, Corkscrew, it kind of felt like the new normal was okay. Because most of the people, you know, you go online, I appreciate being able to pre-order my barbecue knowing that they were going to have it. That's number one, right? So right. I ordered it. Here's my time. They're not going to be sold out. And then just people were kind of like getting it and going. And it just felt like okay. But you take a Brasserie where that's more, we're used to going there eating, enjoying it there, it would be a different feel. Definitely a different feel. I could see how you would feel like that. And it's kind of like you want that. I would want to eat that there, right? Like I would.
I got it. Right. I mean, I got a dozen oysters and, you know, tuna tartare, right? Those things don't necessarily travel well. They really have to eat at a restaurant. And the food was fine, but it's just, I'm still kind of making the leap on the atmosphere. And, you know, there's always that mild disappointment when you know, you go to order that bottle of wine you want, and they're out of it. So,
yeah.
And they've got a good wine list. We found something else that was about the same amount of money that we enjoyed, but you know, there's that mild disappointment. I will say I got takeout from Rosie Cannonball. I got a grilled chicken dish and that blistered green bean salad and a pint of gelato from their pastry chef, Sean Gall. And, you know, it's a funny sort of thing, right? Because part of what makes eating at Rosie Cannonball so good is how sort of thoughtful the service is, right? You sit down, they give you that little taste of sparkling Lambrusco. It's like they're very attuned to your needs. So since they can't do those things, there was a little handwritten card in the bag with the food, you know, thank you for supporting us. I just thought that was a really thoughtful touch. And of course, I live close enough to Rosie Cannonball that it doesn't take long to get the food home and get it on a plate. And I thought it held up really well. And that that pistachio gelato, when that's available, is one of the better ice cream style desserts. And I just, you know, I consider a pint a single serving. So crushed that, ate the chicken, green beans, a very satisfying meal.
Yeah, I have that one on my list too. So now that you've said that, I have that one on my list to get over to get for takeout. And, you know, I got to get to Candente this week for their happy hour. So, you know, maybe we can meet over there and see how we're feeling. Cause they're doing the patio kind of outside, which is great. We have natural air, the fresh air. So let's check that out and see how we fare.
Well, yeah, let me know. I'm definitely down to join you at Candente.
Yeah, so let's make it happen. Happy hour today.
All right. That does it for our restaurants of the week. Felice, thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you. I look forward to us getting back in the studio one day soon. If not, continuing to do this and just, you know, getting back to whatever our new normal looks like.
Absolutely. All right. I will be right back with John Holler.
You're listening to What's Eric Eating?
I am joined this week by John Holler. He is the co-owner of Holler Brewing Company in Sawyer Yards. John, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks, Eric. I'm doing fine here. It's a lovely day. I'm up here at the brewery, just finished cleaning a tank. And happy to be here with you.
Well, thanks for doing this. I always like to start these interviews kind of at the beginning. So just tell me a little bit, I mean, what made you want to get into the world of brewing beer for a living?
Oh, man. You know, I miss telling this story. We haven't been telling this story recently because we've always just been talking about COVID. So
but that's coming. But
I know we will. Yeah, I know. But this is nice. Like, I have to go back to what seems like the Middle Ages now, or like, different a lifetime ago before all this, in our much simpler and more innocent time. What were we doing when we got into this business? Catherine and I, we got into home brewing. We moved to Houston we graduated college and moved to Houston for work. So we kind of made our adult lives here in Houston. And I worked for an oil company, Oil Behemoth, and, Catherine worked as a teacher, a middle school teacher, and we got into home brewing, and we really just got into craft beer. I mean, we loved going to St. Arnold. We loved going when Buffalo Bayou opened and Carbach opened. We just kind of fell hard for craft beer and everything that it stood for. When we traveled, we found that it was, you know, a way to experience another city or another country, was to go to the breweries and drink the beer and talk to the people, the other patrons there, talk to the people who work there and get a nice buzz. So we just loved everything about it. And we moved overseas. My company moved me to Doha, Qatar, in the Middle East. We moved overseas in 2013. And at that time, craft beer had really it was having a real renaissance, or just a real watershed moment in Houston, with several breweries opening right around that time. Eighth Wonder I think had just was just opening. Buffalo Bayou and Carbach had just opened. And there were several other breweries, you know, getting announced that were going to be opening in the area. More beer bar, you know, Hay Merchant had recently opened. And we were just, we were really sad to leave the beer scene behind. And we moved overseas. And we enjoyed our time out in a different part of the world. But we still felt this nagging feeling that we were missing out on something. And we were following it from afar. You know, looking at all the breweries opening in Houston and all the breweries opening in the U.S., this boom going on. And it seemed like so much fun and something we were so interested in that we really wanted to participate in it. And we just kept thinking about it and we decided, well, why don't we? Why don't we just do it? And there were plenty of reasons not to. But as we kind of worked through each of them, we convinced ourselves that we could overcome all those reasons, you know. Oh, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to make it work? How are we going to make any money doing this? You know, we're used to having these nice jobs where we make enough money. And we just decided, well, we'll learn to live on less and we'll figure it out, kind of figure it out as we go. And we put together a business plan and it was, well, how are we going to get the training in order to do that? You know, we're just home brewers and we found there's a brewing school in Chicago that I signed up for. And so that was, you know, that was the plan, was to come back here, start this brewery from scratch. And that's what we did. So we came back here in we quit our jobs, moved back here in January of 2015 and, put together the funding. I went to brewing school. We found this lease on this space out here in Sawyer Yards. And then it took, so in total, it took about a year and a half or maybe a year and 10 months because November of 2016 is when we finally opened. And so we've been open now for, 3.5 years or so. That's our biography.
What I think is so interesting about Holler is, and you're not unique in this necessarily, but you're a little bit different than, you know, the St. Arnold and Eighth Wonders of the world in that you really are focused on your tap room. You're in a few bars, you know, on draft, but you don't really, you're not in kind of grocery stores or retail outlets. There's no cans of Holler on store shelves. Right. There's no bottles. Why did you kind of make the decision to be that kind of smaller neighborhood brewery instead of a larger brewery with a more retail focus?
I think I can't decide which of these two reasons it is. I've convinced myself that it's both of these reasons. But this was what we decided early on, was firstly that that's what we wanted to do. That we didn't want to have we quit our jobs to do something fun. And we didn't want this thing to turn into something that's not fun. And so one way to avoid that is to keep it small and stay connected to the product to the point where, you know, I'm still brewing and we're still serving our beer. Well, we don't really serve it that much anymore. We've delegated that, but we're still well connected to the product. And, but the other reason, and maybe this is the real reason, the real kind of strategic reason, was that when we looked at the time, we saw that everyone else was going for a large distribution footprint. It was St. Arnold, obviously, had been doing that for decades, but everyone else was trying to be St. Arnold at the time anyway. It was, you know, that everyone was kind of building a miniature version of St. Arnold, and the goal was eventually to be St. Arnold. And you couldn't pick a better role model if that's what you're trying to do, but we thought, you know, let's just do something that everyone else isn't trying to do. And you pointed out that we're not the only ones that thought of that. And that's if you think of the number of breweries nowadays in the U.S. of 8,000 breweries, there are, you know, thousands of those breweries are like ours, which is that, yeah, they focus on fresh beer. But what we saw was that even if that's the case, even if there are 30 other breweries just like ours in the city, no one can compete with our actual brewery because our product is extremely fresh and local. And the only brewery that could compete with ours in terms of the the freshness of beer would be one that's just as small as ours and that's right next door to us. So, you know, we build our beer. If you're 10 times or 100 times the size of our brewery, you can't sell all of your beer in your backyard. You can't sell all of your beer in your tap room or close to it. Your beer has to travel farther. And therefore, you have to build the beer differently. You have to build in some shelf life to the product. And you have to make a different product. So I hate to use the word because I do this sometimes too, but you have to compromise. And so we thought, well, let's make this business one where we are committed to that small scale and that no one can compete with us on the freshness of the beer unless they were right next to us. And we have breweries right next to us, but still relative to the amount of demand there is, you know, all I need is a loyal following of, you know, 200, 300 really loyal customers that we've connected to. And that's my business right there. I don't have to worry about building a product for shelf life to travel out to, you know, customers across the state. So it's fun to do it this way. And we see it as a competitive advantage, frankly.
Well, and does being that small, does that allow you to do, are there styles of beer that maybe don't hold up as well or don't lend themselves to shelf life considerations that you're able to brew because you know you're going to move through it pretty quickly?
Yeah, I'd say I can't think of an example of that actually, but there's definitely times where we're making a niche style that would not move, you know, that and we'll talk to brewers at the larger breweries and they'll say, damn man, I wish we could make an English mild like you guys do, but we wouldn't sell enough of it. So what we see more often, the luxury that we enjoy is that we don't need mass appeal for all of our products. So, you know, we've made a great example is a Rausch beer. It's a smoked, using smoked malt in a beer. And it's a highly divisive style. Some people love it. Some people hate it. I happen to love it if it's done well. But a large brewery has trouble doing that because unless you're really into that style, you're either going to hate it or you're going to find it really weird. And so if you have a minimum batch size that's 100 times the size of ours, you know, every batch of beer that you make, you have to commit behind it a lot of investment in the ingredients, an investment in a kind of a marketing plan. You've got to get your whole team on, you know, your whole marketing team on board with it, and they've got to get their reps on board with it. They've got to talk to their accounts and make sure that they're on board with it. And that's something that these you know, not like picking on San Juan, that's something that San Juan does really, really well. But they're not going to do it for a Rausch beer. They're not going to do it for an English mild. Some of these more obscure styles that have hardcore fans, but just don't have enough of them to carry that style. We're able to do those styles without, I mean, we don't have to even think about it. We know that it may sell a little bit slower than our other products, but we'll still be able to sell it. And we're not committing. If we do have to dump it for commercial reasons, which is like the saddest thing ever that I have had to do before, we're not dumping someone's payroll down the drain or anything that big. It's just the commitment's a lot lower. So that small size definitely gives us the flexibility to play around more.
I got to say, dumping a batch down the drain sounds like the worst.
Oh,
you know,
man.
You know, all the jokes about alcohol abuse, right? Like when somebody spills their beer, you know, it's like that's the worst.
It is. And every brewer will tell you that especially if you're dumping it for quality reasons, which is more common, which is, you know, something went wrong with the batch. Sometimes you end up in a situation where actually almost all the time it's a situation where the beer isn't so bad that it's undrinkable, but you know that something's wrong with it. And so you go through these stages of grief and you just go through a lot of internal struggle, and you're thinking, well, because the problem is, you know, deep down, something's wrong with it. Yet you also know that you could probably sell it and get away with it. And so there's that like temptation of, hey, let's just sell it. It'll be gone in the next 2 or 3 weeks and no one will ever know. And you won't have had to dump that beer down the drain. But then again, you will, that whole time, you will know that you're selling beer that you're not proud of. It might manifest itself in you and your conscience in some way that could end up harming you irreparably. Or, you know, the one that we used a lot was that we would tell ourselves was the Brock Wagner test, which was, you know who Brock Wagner is.
Yes, the founder of St. Arnold. He's been on the show.
Yeah, so we would say, for any beer, before you decide to sell it, you know, would you be proud to serve that to Brock Wagner? If he came in, if he decided to, I don't know why he would, but if he decided to come in here one day and try our beer, would you be nervous to serve that beer to Brock Wagner? And or would you be proud to serve that beer to Brock Wagner? And if you have to question that, or if the answer is no, then your answer is you dump it down the drain. And even St. Arnold dumps batches down the drain sometimes, and it's and the brewers will tell you, whoever, when you do it, that it's always the right decision to dump it, and it's a horrible experience, but you feel so relieved afterward because you know you made the right, you know, it's one of those difficult decisions, but you know you made the right call.
Yeah, it seems like the sort of thing where if you have to ask, should we dump this down the drain, then you should probably dump it down the drain. The other Brock Wagner test is Brock always talks about, he always wants to brew a beer where he drinks one and then he wants a second, which kind of governs, you know, some of those, you know, St. Arnold's a little easy drinking, you know, a little smoother maybe than some of the other some of the other breweries out there. I don't know that Brash has that same that same calculus.
Well, you know, that's about drinkability, I think, is one word we use for that, which is how, you know, can you drink 2 or 3 or 10 of these beers? And man, like the definition of drinkability has changed a lot, or the standard of drinkability has changed a lot. You know, some of the beers on the market now are so sweet, heavy, if I want to try and not be too colorful on my opinion of this, there are some beers that are, you have one sip of it and it's delicious and it blows away, you know, it's a sensory overload just from one sip. And those beers right now are very popular, and there are some breweries that actually make a living on those, like make a killing on brewing only those beers. And on the other end of the spectrum is a St. Arnold, who says, they have some of their barrel aged stuff that are more sippers, but even those are highly drinkable for the styles that they are. And then all the mainstays of St. Arnold, those are beers that you could drink several of, and actually, you know, one sip of one of those beers might not be all that impressive if you're expecting a sensory overload. It might be underwhelming if you're expecting a sensory overload. I'm with them. I mean, I think a good beer is one that, and I think Brash would say this too, that, you know, if you can't drink a full pint of it and want another one, it's not a good beer.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely some of those like malty, you know, porter stout type beers where I'll have a sniffer, you know, 6 ounces or whatever of it, and like that is all of that beer I need for my entire life.
Yeah,
like this was interesting. I respect the craftsmanship that went into this. I never need to drink this again.
Yeah, it's that's right. And that's a meal in itself. You know, the other thing is a lot of those drinkable beers, you know, they go well with food, whereas some of these beers have so much going on in them that there is, you know, you can't, it will clash with just about anything. So, it's a meal in itself. It's apples and oranges.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about, the coronavirus, because I can't tell if being as small as you are makes it easier to survive this, or if
losing access to your tap room, which was kind of the whole thing that makes you special, has been really detrimental. So you tell me, what's it been like for you guys without your tap room?
Oh, it's a mixed bag in that. I think that's a good question. We certainly our business is all draft beer. I mean, we sell in the tap room, all our beer is draft, and then we do a decent amount of account sales here in town, and they're all draft. So, you know, this basically, the coronavirus essentially shut off all of our sales channels. So that, you know, compared to, say, a brewery that has packaged beer that's going on to store shelves, they've still got an avenue, whereas our sales channels were all traditional sales channels are all pretty much shut down. But one thing that I'm proud of is that we have made a conscious decision to stay small since we've opened. And it's not as though we could have chosen, you know, to be as successful as, say, a St. Arnold, but we have chosen not to even try to come close. That we've chosen to, rather than chasing growth every year, we've tried to just stay small and focus on not only focusing on making better beer than we did the prior year, but also maintaining a strong balance sheet so that if something did happen, we could absorb, you know, whatever that hit would be. And so, you know, we don't have any debt. We're not overextended in terms of commitments. So the only debt that we have, I guess, would be our lease, if you consider that debt. So anyway, when this thing hit in March, when it got real in March, we kind of sat down and said, well, we are going to have to pretty much shut down because we don't have any sales channels. That's the bad news. And it is bad news, and we have to lay off our employees, which is bad news. Never thought I would have to do that, never wanted to do that. But the good news is we can afford to stay shut down as long as we have to. So we're not sitting here in this compromised position of if I can't get going in the next 24 hours, I'm going to owe a bank my entire business. So we've been able to sleep better at night. Knowing that we can stay patient with this thing.
And you've done a little bit of, you know, you set up a drive-through, you did a little bit of delivery. I mean,
Yeah, that's true. I guess we haven't been completely shut down. So you're right. And we maintained we were going for like 7 weeks. We didn't brew anything. So another thing that's been convenient for us is that we keep all our beer in serving tanks rather than kegs. So and beer actually stores better in serving tanks because less liquid is exposed to oxygen. So we didn't have an issue with having to move inventory quickly. And we had, you know, eight tanks of fresh beer sitting in the cooler that would stay fresh as long as we need it to. And so we didn't have to brew any, we weren't going to brew any more beer. We had to lay off all our staff, but we did start a delivery program where we, you know, basically just filled cans off of those tanks to order. And I delivered them around town. And that allowed us to pay that's a pretty inefficient way to get beer out there, delivering it one, you know, sometimes one can at a time into someone's apartment complex. But it helped us stay connected with our customers, and it did put enough money in the bank to, you know, keep us paying our rent without having to dip into savings.
You know, that's how I spread this podcast, by the way. I just take people's phones and subscribe them to it individually. it's not very efficient, yeah. But it is very effective.
That's right. And you've earned those people, their loyalty, right? Because you've made sure that, you've taken their phone and you've made sure that this podcast is going to automatically download whether they want it or not.
That's right.
whether you listen to it, I need the numbers, right?
The download
the thing, you know, whether you listen to it, you can put it on mute for all I care, just, you know, whatever, but
that's not too much to ask. Yeah.
I think I did it like to my family. That's how the audience got started. I was, give me your phone. So no, I completely relate. Now that we're sort of easing back into normal, I know Governor Abbott just announced that breweries can reopen at 25% capacity. I mean, do you think that you will reopen your tap room and start getting some people through the door again?
That's a big question. That's on everyone's mind, and we're all talking about it. We are looking seriously at the next step. And, I think for us, it's a matter of when, of course. But we've brought back, Jorge is our hospitality director, our one full-time employee that we had. And we brought him back a couple of weeks ago to start back up the curbside operation that's been going for a week. And, we've been having serious discussions about what it's going to look like when we open the tap room. And, when I say tap room, it's probably going to be more like just patio. So, you know, you come in, you could just sit on the patio and we'll bring beer out to you. Or you can come in and order. It'll be plastic cups only, you know, a lot of changes. But yeah, we are looking at opening the patio for customer use. We just got to figure out exactly when and put the finishing touches on sanitizing protocols for customers and using the bathrooms and things like that. But yeah, I think we're eager, but we want to do it right.
Right. There is that kind of balance between, you know, being excited to kind of do what you do, but also being conscious about, you know, we're still living with this disease and it's not necessarily clear like how fast it's spreading or who's at risk I feel like, you know, our understanding of what we're supposed to be doing has been changing ever since January. So.
Oh yeah, man. It's been a wild, wild ride. I think, it's just so crazy. And I think we all want, we all want to eliminate the uncertainty, you know, have all the testing in place so that we know who's got it. I think we're in a position now where we've got to make a decision under uncertainty. And it's been pretty uncomfortable and scary at times. And, you don't want to, there's nothing I would regret more than opening too soon or recklessly and being responsible for deaths. So
right.
So yeah, it's crazy. I cannot believe that we're here making these decisions, but that's what we have to do. And I think I'll put in a plug for local businesses. The beauty of local businesses is that we are so accountable to our customers. Business like ours, my customers, they know where I live. They know where I work. Our name is on the building. So like, I don't need any governor or mayor or city official to scare me. I am plenty scared of, we own these consequences. So when we're going out there and if we make an announcement that we're going to be opening, you know, I know that customers are going to be reading that closely, that our fans are going to be reading that closely, and considering, are we doing the right thing? And I know we're going to hear about it. So, and I think that's great. I think that's exactly how the world should work. And that's what, I think that's one of the things that's so beautiful about owner operated local businesses.
Yeah. And I've been kind of saying this for the last couple of weeks is I really do think it is, you know, without like very clear mandates from the government that I just don't think we're going to get, we really do have individual responsibilities to to go to a business or not go to a business based on kind of how comfortable we feel. Like I'm still only eating on patios, and I won't eat at a restaurant where the servers aren't wearing masks. Mm-hmm. And I recognize mm-hmm. there are, you know, plenty of people walking into, you know, Steak 48 has been very public about, you know, we're not wearing masks. Well, that's their decision as a business, right? They're in compliance with the law if they have enough social distancing and they're following capacity restrictions and all of that. But as a consumer, like I'm voting with my wallet. I'm not going to Steak 48. And yeah. You know, based on some of the pictures I've seen on social media, there are, you know, a couple of hundred people a night that are making a different decision. But, you know, I think kind of letting the market work and letting people make their own decisions is probably about the best we can hope for at this point.
I'm with you. Yeah.
So do you have kind of post coronavirus plans? I mean, you know, it's gotten real busy for breweries in your part of the world. You've had Platypus there for a while now, but then you've been kind of recently joined by Buffalo Bayou and now Urban South. I mean, do you kind of feel like the market is changing, or do you feel kind of pretty confident about the future of Holler Brewing?
Oh, we, you know, I 2 months ago I could have had a view, but now I just don't know that this coronavirus recovery, the coronavirus and the recovery is such an X factor that any predictions that I had about, you know, small market moves will be overwhelmed by how this will play out. But I think we're still in a place. Actually, I think that if it's any indication, you know, we set up our deliveries and to-go sales pretty much overnight, and we didn't expect much support at all, but we've gotten a ton of support from the community. And I know that those other, that Platypus and Buff and Urban South have too. So, you know, I think the fact that people are willing to venture out and support these breweries, even though the product is more expensive than if you got it at a grocery store, they are willing to pay that premium for that product and support these breweries. So I think, you know, if the demand is as strong as it's been. Now, don't get me wrong, our sales volume is well below what it normally is in our tap room, but it's stronger than I would have expected, which has been encouraging. So I would say that the market is, there is plenty of market to support more breweries in Houston. And actually before coronavirus, you know, when Buff Brew opened, we had been seeing increased business from, you know, more people wanting to come to this area and try all the breweries. So I think especially when talking to folks in the restaurant business, they hear of one brewery opening across from another, and that's like a threat. Yeah. But and if it was one fried chicken place opening across from another fried chicken place, yeah, it probably would be, because you don't have people that are going, you don't have very many people who are going and eating, you know, two fried chicken meals in one day. But in beer, it's like there's a network effect there where they say, oh, actually, that area has multiple breweries versus that other area that only has one brewery. Well, if I'm going to go out today, I'm going to go Sawyer Yard so that I can hit up all those breweries. And that's the effect that we had heard that effect exists. We have some friends that own breweries in Ballard in Seattle, which has like, it's a one neighborhood with like 13 or 14 breweries within a couple of square miles. And they were all like, yeah, it's still going great. We don't know when what the threshold is, but we can support 13 or some ridiculous number of breweries in this neighborhood. But yeah, we're seeing that same thing here, that I think there's still, as long as this recovery happens, I think there still is a lot of support for going to local breweries, and we can support these four, would be my guess.
All right. And then I meant to ask you this kind of in the background section, but I'm always this is something I'm stealing from Chris Wyatt, a local beer enthusiast, but what was your
Twitter?
Yeah, shout out to beer_Chris on Twitter.
What about beer?
What was your gateway beer? Like, what was the first craft beer that made you kind of kick away from, you know, the national macro, whatever that you had been drinking before that?
You know, I think it was, it would have been some Belgian beer, actually, because I was in college and I was in a college town. And so all we had was like Natty Light and Busch Light and the sort. But there was one bar in that, in Gainesville, Florida, that had, at the time, it was all these fancy imported beers. And I just remember trying the, I think it may have been Delirium Tremens. But I remember the Belgian beers just tasted like so, I mean, I couldn't believe they were beer. They're just so, such a, you know, they're still drinkable, but such an aromatic experience. I remember the, you know, the trying the different Belgian triples and even the Belgian blondes, like a, even a, oh God, I hate to say this, even Stella at that time, I was like, man, the beer is just so much higher quality than anything I've had. And so that opened my eyes to the idea that there's beer and then there's beer, you know. I don't know my first American craft beer, but yeah, I imagine it was like a Sierra Nevada or at that time in that area, Sweetwater, like Sweetwater 420 was really big. And I drank a fair amount of that.
Right. Like I went to college on the East Coast. So, you know, the summer I turned 21, I was living in Boston. So for me, it was Sam Adams Summer Ale.
Yeah.
And it was, cool. You know, citrus and a little bit spicy and refreshing and just totally different than anything I had ever had before. And that was
the contrast.
That's what opened the door.
Yeah. The contrast between any of those beers and a Bud Light or a Natty Light is just so insane. I mean, it can be, yeah, it's so different. Yeah, Boston beer, Sam Adams was like was probably the first craft beer. It probably converted more people to craft beer than every other craft brewery combined.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I don't know. We're running a little long, so I had in my notes a three-tier system. Do you want to do a 2-minute? Do you want to do a 2-minute rant about three-tier system, or should I bring you back like in 6 months to dive into that?
I'm hoping that, you know, the coronavirus kind of puts a wrench into the three-tier system. You know, the coronavirus has shown us that a lot of these silly laws are really unnecessary. Like the, you know, for example, that I remember at the beginning they got rid of, or it was, I guess it was somehow illegal to do telemedicine, or telemedicine was like really difficult. A lot of the providers wouldn't do it. And then the government just decided, oh, well, let's get rid of this law that prevents it. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, well, it's okay to do telemedicine now. Oh, well, that law was stupid to begin with.
I think people really like this ability to buy bottles of wine or cocktail kits, or maybe if they tweak the laws a little bit, pre-made cocktails from bars and restaurants. And I kind of hope that we do take another swing at this, because I think that once you kind of give consumers these choices, it's really hard to take them away.
Yeah, because then you have to, because the whole reason why all this is illegal is because it's a fear mongering that, well, if we made it legal, then the world would collapse. The world as we know it would collapse. And that argument has been taken away now because they made it legal and everyone's still fine. And now customers have gotten a taste of something that they like. Businesses have gotten a taste of something that they like. And now the government's on their back foot, you know, would have to explain why they're taking away our liberty. So, yeah, I hope it gets chipped away at a little bit.
All right. Well, we are running long, but I can't wrap this up without running you through the lightning round.
Okay.
5 easy questions, 5 short answers. Just say the first thing that comes to mind. John Holler, what is your favorite non-Holler beer?
Oh, I would say St. Arnold's Summer Pils.
What is the first band you saw in concert?
Oh, man, I saw this. It was called Kiss Party 95 for Kiss FM in Dallas, Texas. I was I was in third grade, and I went with my dad, and the headliner was Duran Duran.
Oh, that's a great answer. All right. Who is your what is your fast food guilty pleasure? It has to come from a restaurant with a drive-thru.
El Rey, the one on Washington and Shepherd. I get the giant Cuban burrito.
Yep.
Who is your favorite Houston sports figure, past or present?
Dikembe Mutombo.
With the finger wag, very solid.
Yeah.
And then, finally, when you go to a pizzeria for the first time, what are your go-to toppings?
Anything. Yeah, I mean, I go with something with red sauce, mozzarella cheese, and some kind of a pork product on top. So I don't start with anything fancy, just pepperoni or sausage or prosciutto, something like that.
Very good. All right, give us the website and the social media for Holler Brewing.
Check us out. Holler Beer is our social media is HOLLERBER. So at Holler Beer for Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and then website is hollerbeer.com.
John, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, Eric. This was great.
Yeah. You can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.